fairy is a type of mythical being or legendary creature in European folklore, and particularly in Celtic, Slavic, German, English, and French folklore. A form of spirit, often described as metaphysical or supernatural. Various folk theories about the origins of fairies include casting them as either demoted angels or demons in Christian tradition, as minor deities in pre-Christian pagan belief systems, as spirits of the dead, as prehistoric precursors to humans, or as elementals. According to Paracelsus, the 16th century alchemist, there are four categories of elementals that he describes as creatures that are outside the cognizance of the light of nature. And they are gnomes of the earth, undines, which are associated with water, and later writers turned into the water nymph. They're sylphs, which are invisible beings of the air, and salamanders, which are lizard-like and associated with the fire element. The Paracelsian concept of elementals draws from several much older traditions in mythology and religion. Alphonse Louis Constant, better known by his pen name Eliphas Levi, was a master of the traditional Rosicrucian interpretation of the Kabbalah. He was born in France in 1810 and was educated for the Church of Saint Sulpice. He was later expelled from seminary for teaching doctrines contrary to those of the Roman Catholic Church. In 1824, Levi began studying the occult sciences and wrote about magic and the Kabbalah for the next three decades, and was imprisoned twice for the critical nature of his work. First published in 1913, his book, The History of Magic, includes chapters on magic of the Magi, magic in ancient Greece, the Kabbalah, primitive symbolism, mysticism, oracles, magical monuments, magic and Christianity, pagan magic, Kabbalistic paintings and sacred emblems, sorcerers, magic and Freemasonry, the Illuminati, and more. That said, I'd like to read a brief excerpt from his work. The History of Magic by Eliphas Levi. There's no need to recapitulate what has been said concerning this master in our doctrine and ritual of transcendental magic, but something may be added on the occult medicine restored by Paracelsus. This truly universal medicine is based upon a spacious theory of light called by adepts fluid or potable gold. Light, that creative agent, the vibrations of which are the movement and life of all things. Light, latent in the universal ether, radiating about absorbing centers, which, being saturated, thereby project movement and life in their turn, so forming creative currents. Light, astralized in the stars, animalized in animals, humanized in human beings. Light, which vegetates in plants, glistens in metals, produces all forms of nature, and equilibrates all of the laws of universal sympathy. This is that light which exhibits the phenomena of magnetism, divined by Paracelsus, which tinctures in the blood, being released from the air as it is inhaled and discharged by the hermetic bellows of the lungs. The blood then becomes a true elixir of life, wherein ruby and magnetic globules of vital light float in a slightly gilded fluid. These globules are actual seeds, ready to assume all forms of that world whereof the human body is an abridgment. They can become rarefied and coagulated, so renewing the humors which circulate in the nerves and in the flesh encompassing the bones. They radiate outside, or rather, in rarefying, they are drawn by the currents of light and circulate in the astral body, that interior and luminous body which is dilated by the imagination of ecstatics, so that their blood sometimes colors objects at a distance when these have been penetrated and identified with the astral body. In a special work on occult medicine, that which is stated here will be proved, however strange and paradoxical it may seem at first sight to men of science. Such were the bases of medicine as put forward by Paracelsus. He cured by sympathy of light. He administered medicaments not to the outward material body, which is entirely passive, which can be rent and cut up without feeling anything when the astral body has withdrawn, but to the inward medium, to that vehicle which is the source of sensations. The quintessence of these he renewed by sympathetic quintessences. For example, he healed wounds by applying powerful reactives to the spilt blood, thus sending back its physical soul and purified sap to the body. To cure a diseased limb, he made a limb of wax and, by willpower, transferred thereto the magnetism of the diseased limb. He then treated the wax with vitriol, iron, and fire, thus reacting by imagination and magnetic correspondence on the sick person himself, to whom the limb of wax had become an appendix and supplement. Paracelsus knew the mysteries of blood. He knew why the priests of Baal made incisions with knives in their flesh and then brought down the fire from heaven. He knew why Orientals poured out their blood before a woman to inspire her with physical love. He knew how spilt blood cries for vengeance or mercy and fills the air with angels or demons. Blood is the instrument of dreams and multiplies images in the brain during sleep because it is full of the astral light. Its globules are bisexual, magnetized, and metalled, sympathetic and repelling. All forms and images in the world can be evoked from the physical soul of blood. Most people have heard of the Book of the Dead, an ancient Egyptian funerary text generally written on papyrus, but also on tomb paintings used from as early as the 3rd dynasty of Egypt, which was a little under 5,000 years ago, to around 50 BC. Prior to the New Kingdom, the Book of the Dead was only available to royalty and the elite. The title was given by Western scholars, and the actual original Egyptian name for the text is translated as Book of Coming Forth by Day, or Book of Emerging Forth into the Light, and was used as a guide, containing a set of instructions and a collection of spells with the goal of enabling the soul of the deceased to navigate the afterlife. To the ancient Egyptians, death was not an ending, and the afterlife was considered to be a continuation of life, where the soul passed through various difficulties and judgments, and so this afterlife manual was considered extremely useful. It also provided the soul with foreknowledge of what would be expected, and there wasn't one version, but this would be customized for the individual. That said, there have been some interesting articles that came out this week concerning what some are calling the ancient Egyptian board game of death. The game, called Senet, was played at all levels of Egyptian society from when it first emerged 5,000 years ago until it fell out of favor about 2,500 years later. Egyptologists believe Senet was played by two competitors on a board that resembled a cross between chess and backgammon, where each person has 5 pawns that were placed on a grid of 30 squares arranged in 3 rows of 10. Then, by a roll of the dice, players would move their pawns, with the goal being to have all 5 of your pawns reach the finish point at the lower right-hand corner of the board. Egyptian texts describe the game as depicting the movement of the soul through the Egyptian realm of the dead. Players threw an ancient equivalent of gaming dice to establish how many squares to move one of their pawns on a given turn. The use of dice seems to also have added an element of divination to the activity. A Senet board is located in the Rosicrucian Egyptian Museum, and while some believe the board started out as entertainment, Egyptian tomb art depicts the tomb's dead inhabitant playing Senet against living friends and relatives, with texts from the time suggesting the game had been seen as a conduit through which the dead could communicate with the living. The age and archaeological context of the Rosicrucian board are unclear, but some archaeologists believe its style is unique to Egypt's Middle Kingdom period, between 4,000 and 3,700 years ago, and was probably about 3,500 years old. If you'd like to see it in person, the Rosicrucian Museum is located in San Jose, California. Architecturally inspired by the Temple of Amon in Karnak, it houses the largest collection of Egyptian artifacts on exhibit in Western North America, including objects from pre-dynastic times through Egypt's early Islamic era. The Rosicrucian Museum began with one small artifact, a Sekhmet or Lion Goddess statue, which stood on the desk of H. Spencer Lewis, the founder of the Rosicrucian Order. It costs between $5 and $9 per person to visit, I think depending on age, but if you can't make it yourself, I've included a brief tour here so you can get a feel of what it's like on the inside. The Rosicrucians are a worldwide organization that claims to possess esoteric wisdom handed down from ancient times. The name derives from the order's symbol, a rose on a cross, which is similar to the family coat of arms of Martin Luther. Rosicrucian teachings are a combination of occultism, which means secret, as much of the esoteric interpretations of ancient and alchemical knowledge carried a death penalty by the church, and other religious beliefs and practices, including Hermeticism, Jewish mysticism, and Christian Gnosticism. The central feature of Rosicrucianism is the belief that its members possess secret wisdom that was handed down from ancient times, and by that I mean antediluvian, or from the times of the mythical Atlantis that Plato wrote about. Rosicrucianism was attractive to many thinkers throughout Europe, possibly including the English philosopher and scientist Francis Bacon. In a prior video I made, I put forth a theory that Bacon was the true identity of William Shakespeare, as well as being a Freemason who played a role in editing the King James Bible. There should be a link in the description for those that would like to watch it. There have been several founders of various branches of the organization through the years, and most, if not all of them, subscribe to the idea that ancient Egypt was the cradle of Rosicrucian wisdom, which is why this museum contains so many Egyptian artifacts, which was established in large part by H. Spencer Lewis. Another important modern organization is the Rosicrucian Fellowship, whose founder, Max Hendel, attended lectures in Germany by the theosophist Rudolf Steiner. After publishing purportedly secret doctrines against Steiner's wishes, Hendel taught a form of Rosicrucianism heavily influenced by theosophy, a religion established by Madame Helena Blavatsky based on any of a number of philosophies maintaining that a knowledge of God may be achieved through spiritual ecstasy, direct intuition, or internal alchemy through special relations. The work of Rudolf Steiner is unique in the way that it combines esoteric teaching with practical suggestions for spiritual development. Indeed, Steiner is best known today for the application of his ideas in areas such as education, medicine, and agriculture. But none of this could have developed without the coherent and profound body of spiritual knowledge, which stands at the very core of Steiner's work. In his book titled Rosicrucian Wisdom, He goes on to describe many facets of what he considers esoteric spiritual truth, including the law of destiny, the fact of life after death, ways of developing spiritual vision or insight, humanity's past and future evolution, and he tried to find a synthesis between science and spirituality, which he termed spiritual science. Another less known fact is that Rudolf Steiner, the founder of Anthroposophy, was leader of the German branch of the OTO for 9 years before World War I. OTO stands for Ordo Templi Orientis, an occult organization that was once headed by Aleister Crowley and is notorious for allegedly practicing ancient sex magic, rituals, and other esoteric ceremonies based on Kabbalistic practices. Of course, there's a big difference between Crowley and Steiner, as Crowley introduced his own alternative practices into the order, so it would be unfair to assume that all occult, alchemical, or Kabbalistic practices resembled Crowley's grades, which I won't go into in this presentation. That said, the erotic energy that is harnessed in all mystery school religions is central to the order, and any member that denies this does so because they're either under oath or lying about their involvement. This leads us to the question, what is magic really about? In the words of Aleister Crowley, quote, "Magic is the science or art of causing change on a material as well as on a spiritual level to occur in conformity with will by altered states of consciousness," end quote. I'd like to emphasize the last part about altered states, as this is key and is not something Crowley made up because he liked taking drugs, but goes back into antiquity, especially in ancient Egypt, Babylon, India, Greece, and Iran. Right before the rise of Christianity, which was disseminated by the Roman Empire, the Mithraic mysteries held sway, and these altered states of ecstasy are what later became known as Gnostic trances, or gnosis, a Hellenistic term which means intuitive, revealed knowledge from within, what some associate with the ancient term know thyself. An amplified and extended climax is said to provide a natural, hyper-lucid Gnostic trance, which traditionally leads a practitioner to clairvoyance. Which brings us back to a closer look at the work of Rudolf Steiner. Born in 1861, Rudolf Steiner was an Austrian philosopher, social reformer, architect, economist, and esotericist. Steiner gained initial recognition at the end of the 19th century as a literary critic and published philosophical works, including The Philosophy of Freedom. When he was 9 years old, Steiner believed that he saw the spirit of an aunt who had died in a far-off town asking him to help her at a time when neither he nor his family knew of the woman's death. Steiner believed that at the age of 15, he had gained a complete understanding of the concept of time, which he considered to be the precondition of spiritual clairvoyance. In 1891, Steiner received a doctorate in philosophy at the University of Rostock and became a well-known and controversial public figure during and after World War I, and was attacked by the National Socialist German Workers' Party for being, quote, a tool of the Marxists, as Steiner was opposed to Woodrow Wilson's proposal to create new European nations based around ethnic groups, and instead proposed as an alternative, social territories ruled over by democratic institutions. Putting politics aside, Steiner first began speaking publicly about spiritual experiences and phenomena in his 1899 lectures to the Theosophical Society. By 1901, he had begun to write about spiritual topics, initially in the form of discussions of historical figures such as the mystics of the Middle Ages. Very few scientists today are willing to explore metaphysics to examine life beyond ordinary perception in order to make a connection between the seen and the unseen. That said, Rudolf Steiner devoted much of his work to the task of peering behind the veil, sharing his insight into the deeper nature of life and of the world beyond, the world of the unseen. Regarding anxiety and depression, Steiner spoke of hostile beings in the spiritual world which can influence and feed off of human emotion, a concept flatly rejected by most today. Many are familiar with the notion of energy vampires, or people who suck your energy and feed off of negative emotions. On the existence of similar entities which exist in other dimensions, Steiner wrote, and I quote, "There are beings in the spiritual realms for whom anxiety and fear emanating from human beings offer welcome food. When humans have no anxiety and fear, then these creatures starve." People not yet sufficiently convinced of this statement could understand it to mean comparatively only, but for those who are familiar with this phenomenon, it is a reality. If fear and anxiety radiates from people and they break out in panic, then these creatures find welcome nutrition and they become more and more powerful. These beings are hostile towards humanity. Everything that feeds on negative feelings, on anxiety, fear, and superstition, despair, or doubt, are in reality hostile forces in supersensible worlds, launching cruel attacks on human beings while they are being fed. Therefore, it is above all necessary to begin with that the person who enters the spiritual world overcomes fear, feelings of helplessness, despair, and anxiety. But these are exactly the feelings that belong to contemporary culture and materialism, because it estranges people from the spiritual world. It is especially suited to evoke hopelessness and fear of the unknown in people, thereby calling up the above-mentioned hostile forces against them.
Rudolf Steiner's fundamental gift to mankind was the formation of the science of the spirit known as anthroposophy, from the Greek words anthropos, or man, and sophia, or wisdom. In northwestern Switzerland, near the city of Basel, spiritual scientific research is conducted in this building, which is called the Goetheanum. It was named for the German poet, scientist, and philosopher Goethe. It was designed by Dr. Steiner to be the World Center for Anthroposophical Studies and the School of Spiritual Science. He was born on the 27th of February, 1861, in the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, in an out-of-a-way little town, now in Yugoslavia, called Kraljevec. His father was an employee of the old Austrian Railroad. He was a station manager and also a telegraph operator, and the family moved many times during Rudolf Steiner's boyhood. Very early on, this boy discovered that he lived equally in two worlds of reality. He lived in the outer world of reality, which we all share, but he also lived in an inner world of experience, which was as real or realer to him as the world that he could see and hear and touch. Very early on, as early as 7 years, he discovered that when he tried to share with others out of this world of inner experience, that he was met either with disbelief or with scorn and ridicule. And so at this very early age, he learned to keep silent about this world of inner experience. It was at this time, when he was only 8 years of age, that he discovered in his teacher's room a book that gave him the greatest possible joy. And this was a book of geometry. He describes in his autobiography how he spent weeks poring over this volume of geometry. And he said this gave him the confidence that there was in fact a realm of human experience which was accessible only to human thought, not to outer sense perception, but which was accepted as real. His father wanted him to be an engineer and therefore sent him into the neighboring town of Wiener Neustadt at the age of 11. and there he pursued a scientific career studying mathematics, chemistry, physics, and biology. And it was there as a young adolescent at the age of 14 that he one day passed the window of a bookseller in Wiener Neustadt and saw lying there in the window a volume whose author was unknown to him and whose title conveyed no meaning to him whatsoever, but where he suddenly was overcome by the feeling, I must know what this book has to say. And so he spent the next week saving his hard-earned pennies, which he was earning at this time already to supplement the family income, by tutoring boys of his own age or younger, helping them through their examination, and thereby gaining invaluable educational experience. He saved up his pennies and bought the book, and then discovered that the best way to use his time in his history lessons was to take the volume of Immanuel Kant to pieces and to interleave it into his history text, because his history teacher was simply recapitulating in his lectures what was already in the book, and that he could study at home. So although he looked like a serious history student at that moment to the teacher, he was actually absorbed, sometimes reading and rereading the same page 20 times over to understand and to be able to think in his own way the thoughts which he found expressed in this volume. The young Rudolf Steiner at this age hadn't the faintest idea that he was destined then as a mature philosopher to refute Kant, the great philosopher of the 19th century, who had proclaimed that there are absolute limits to human knowledge. Indeed, Steiner's view was quite the opposite and led him to a new and deeper approach to education.
The world of education, which comes out of Steiner's philosophy and his view of the human being, is of course very different from the materialistic one. So two views are extraordinarily prevalent all over the world today when you ask the question, what is a human being? And some people will say, well, a human being is nothing very much more than a highly developed animal. And another view, which is equally prevalent and equally, I think, destructive, is, well, the human being isn't much more than some sort of machine. And we feel, in the world of education, that neither of these answers really meets the true dignity of the human being. So that every human being, whether adult or child, has something in him, has something in her, which is absolutely unique. And we'd like to call that, for the moment, the individuality. And this individuality is born, of course, into a body at birth, goes through a certain development, and gradually that entity, that individuality, becomes more and more himself or herself. And what we're concerned with in education is how can we help that individuality to really become himself or herself, that the full potential which is in this being, in this soul, can really come to expression. And that means that the whole task of education is one of awakening. It's not a question of putting in. And it's interesting how Herodotus, the great Greek historian, put it already in a rather delightful way, I think. Education is not to fill a bucket. Education is to kindle a fire.
In old times, mathematical concepts were used to give images of higher concepts about the divine nature of the world, even as meditation objects. Plato is said to have said, no non-mathematician may enter my school, because he believed strongly in the quality of pure thinking as a basis to grasp the true essence, the true beings, ideas, as they are called in Platonic philosophy. Among all philosophies I know, it is only in anthroposophy that there is such a high esteem of the pure mathematical thought as one of the strongest means to educate the mind to be independent of sense perceptions. Anthroposophy, if I'm to say it in a few words only, tends to give people the possibility of higher knowledge of a world of spiritual beings. But in this world, man would be lost with our present-day custom of thinking in sense-perceptible concepts only. The physical reality is that reality we know. The ideal reality is unknown in our time. It's only mere hot air. Now, anthroposophy has the idea and gives teachings how to develop inner forces to conceive more of that world of, not of ideas only, of spiritual beings, and to have mastery of one's soul in that world. It is extremely helpful to have that mastery about thinking which pure mathematics and even applied mathematics can give you.
Steiner not only believed in entities that occupy spiritual realms, that can and do influence us, he also wrote about such beings which influenced ancient history on Earth. In his book, The Submerged Continents of Atlantis and Lemuria, he writes that, and I quote, "Our Atlantean ancestors differed more from the men of today than may be imagined by anyone who is wholly limited to the world of sense for his knowledge. This difference extends not only to the outward appearance, but also to mental capacities. Their science and also their technical arts, their whole civilization differed much from that of ours today. If we go back to the early times of Atlantean humanity, we shall find there a mental capacity altogether different from our own."
Steiner, mm-hmm. who explicitly claimed that his insights into Atlantis were based on the use of psi ability.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rudolf Steiner is more known as a mystical teacher, a hierophant even, and a clairvoyant. And although he certainly was educated as a philosopher, I don't think he's regarded much in terms of academic philosophy at all.
Well, his early work was in academic philosophy. Mm-hmm. I believe his dissertation was on the subject of free will.
And Friedrich Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so Steiner's own proclivities are perhaps reflected in the way that he handles the story mm-hmm. of Atlantis. He claims that the Atlantean civilization was founded by beings who descended to the earthly plane, mm-hmm. but who were not entirely corporeal at mm-hmm. the outset.
Consistent with theosophical teachings.
Yes. And they became teachers mm-hmm. to a group of early human beings who wound up developing a society that inextricably intertwined what we would consider material advancements in technology with psychical abilities. Mm-hmm. So that on the one hand, you have some of the same technologies that Francis Bacon describes. But on the other hand, Steiner emphasizes that the mind interfaced with some of these devices. Mm-hmm. So that if we were in possession of some of the Atlantean pieces of technology, we probably wouldn't be able to make them work. Or at any rate, someone who wasn't an adept in psychokinesis wouldn't be able to make them work.
It reminds me of the movie Forbidden Planet, the old 1950s science fiction movie.
Actually, that's a very good comparison, because the way the story ends for Rudolf Steiner is that these Atlanteans turn their minds against one another. Mm-hmm. They begin to invade one another's minds with terrifying visions and turn their psychic abilities essentially into a weapon. Mm-hmm. This becomes the cause of the demise of the civilization, although he also agrees with Plato that there was a great flood and earthquakes mm-hmm. as the cause of Atlantis's destruction. He suggests that these alterations in the natural environment were brought about, again, by a misuse of psychic ability or psychokinetic ability.
Which is not so different from Plato's description of Zeus wreaking revenge.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And also Plato's description of the way in which the demigods of Atlantis were beginning to use putatively divine powers for mm-hmm. Secular purposes mm-hmm. that they ought not to have.
Mm-hmm. I suppose in a sense it's an echo of the biblical story of the Tower of Babel.
That's right. I think it is very mm-hmm. much so.
In a way, humans rising up to challenge the gods in one way or another.
Yeah, the most interesting element in Steiner's account is he suggests that at some point a cognitive change took place where we went from a mentality that was based largely on memory, where learning was a question of a vast store of experience, mm-hmm. and the Atlanteans thought in terms of images. We transitioned from that into an analytical mode of thinking, and this destabilized the Atlantean society because only a few people made this transition at first. Mm. And then with their newfound analytical capabilities, they were in a position to manipulate the rest of society. And he actually traced the guru-worshipping cultures of India and the pharaoh-worshipping culture of Egypt to this transformation in Atlantean society.
I see. In other words, that the Atlanteans had godlike kings? Is that the notion?
A few of the people who developed a new form of thinking began to manipulate a society that was still largely linked together psychically through a collective consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks this influenced Egypt and India because after the destruction of Atlantis, the Atlanteans went around and colonized various parts of the world, or perhaps relocated themselves to colonies that they had already established in various regions.
Well, there are some people who wonder about the fact that we have pyramids in Mesoamerica and pyramids in Egypt and other similarities, that there was once a global culture going back to prehistoric times.
Thank you for joining me today. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. You can find my books on Amazon.
Species with Amnesia, Our Forgotten History. Gods with Amnesia, Subterranean Worlds of Inner Earth. The Occult Secrets of Vril. And 1666, Redemption Through Sin.
If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments, so please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.